a Civics for Life conversation with Massimo Pigliucci. I'm Liam Julian with Civics for Life. Massimo Pigliucci is the Katie Irani Professor of Philosophy at the City College of New York. He's the author or editor of 15 books. He's been published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and Salon, among others. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. His latest book is The Quest for Character, what the story of Socrates and Alcibiades teaches us about our search for good leaders. We're going to be talking about that, the search for good leaders, the quest for character, and lots more today. Welcome, Massimo. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your book, your new book begins, chapter one. The title of the chapter is Can Virtue Be Taught? And you write, quote, before we can sensibly ask whether and how virtue can be taught, we need to discuss exactly what virtue is and why we should care about it. And so, what is virtue and why should we care about it?
Yeah, it's a good setup, isn't it? Well, virtue is a character trait, or to be more specific, it's a set of character traits. So there are multiple virtues. For instance, courage or justice or temperance or generosity, etc. Depending on who you ask, the number of virtues that are recognized across cultures vary, but usually a core of six or seven that pretty much every society seems to agree on. And the ones that I just mentioned are usually part of that core. So we're talking about character traits. We're talking about the fact that, you know, if you say that your friend is generous, for instance, what that means is that by and large, other things being equal, your friend will spend time with others, will spend money on behalf of others, will, you know, provide resources, et cetera, because he wants to be helpful. That's what it means to be generous. Now, that doesn't mean that he's going to be generous all the times or in exactly the same way, et cetera. But other things being equal, he's a generous character, as opposed to somebody who suffers from the opposite vice of being stingy, for instance, and so on, right. And so forth. So that's what a virtue is. Now, why is it important? Because social living is based on cooperation and people trying to do, at least within certain limits, good for other people, to try to be, you know, generous and fair and temperate, et cetera, et cetera. And so it turns out that virtue is at the foundations, I think, of any kind of society, of the kinds that human beings usually engage in.
Yeah. So this is a great point that you're making, because I think sometimes, and this may come out of a religious conception of virtue, sometimes people think of virtue and character as sort of an individual thing between myself and God, for example. But the way in which you're talking about virtue and character comes out of a Greco-Roman antiquity sort of notion of virtue and character as being fundamentally social, right?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, that distinction you just made is really crucial, because you're right, the Christian tradition, well, the Abrahamic faiths in general, are about our personal relationship with God, mostly. Yes, that relationship does involve how we treat other people, for sure, but it's mostly about, it's between us and God. And so some of the classical Christian virtues are, you know, faith and hope and things like that. The Greco-Roman approach, on the other hand, is very much pro-social. It is about other people. The virtues are other-directed, essentially. And in fact, the word virtue comes from the Greek arete. And arete just means excellence, so being very good at certain things. And anything can be arete, not just a human being. For instance, the other day, with my wife, I went to a store because we needed a new bread knife, because our original bread knife stopped being arete. In other words, it did not cut well. what is the function of a bread knife? To cut bread. And yeah. If it doesn't cut bread well, then it's not arete. It's not virtuous. It's not a virtuous knife in a sense. And so we got another one. Now, the Greco-Romans had the idea that not only everything has a function and therefore can be good or bad at that function, but the human beings in particular have a function. And that function is to live cooperatively with other human beings. We are fundamentally, as we would say in modern evolutionary terms, we're fundamentally social animals. And so our survival, reproduction, and flourishing all depend on how we interact with other people. So a pro-social nature, a other-oriented virtue is fundamental for human living.
Yeah. And you write in the book, you talk about the Epicureans and Stoics, and for them, how living virtuously helped one to live, quote, in accordance with our nature, which I thought was interesting because, again, I think many people would think of virtue as helping us to rise above our nature. But this conception of nature, right, is that we are fundamentally social beings, social animals. So you talk about in your book, The Quest for Character, you almost present a sort of historical case studies.
Right.
It's really great of famous relationships between tutors and students. And the one that you had introduced first, the one that's in the subtitle of your book, is the relationship between Socrates and his student, Alcibiades. And so maybe you can give us a bit of background about that relationship.
Yeah, that's actually how the book came out in the first place. The idea of the book was originally that I was just fascinated by the character of Alcibiades. In fact, the guy is so interesting that I don't know why nobody's made a movie out of him yet, you know, his life yet. Perhaps soon. But so the guy was, Alcibiades was impossibly handsome, super rich, very brave, dashing kind of character. You know, he had everything except that he had a very flawed character. And so he goes to Socrates because he realizes that he has problems, he has issues. And he goes to Socrates when he's very young, he's in his early 20s, and he's about to be introduced to Athenian society because he wants to become a leader eventually. He wants to become a statesman. And so he goes to Socrates and says, you know, what should I do here? How should I go about doing this thing, pursuing this goal of mine? And Socrates essentially performs what we would today call a job interview, and starts asking questions to Alcibiades, like, so how are you going to go about it? What do you think you're going to do? And he asks questions that are more about Alcibiades' character, however, than about specific policies, right? And at some point, unfortunately, Socrates begins to realize that Alcibiades is not made of the right stuff, and he tells him, and I quote, "Then, alas, Alcibiades, what a condition you suffer from. I hesitate to name it, but since we two are alone, it must be said. You are wedded to stupidity, best of men, of the most extreme sort, as the argument accuses you and you accuse yourself. So this is why you are leaping into the affairs of the city before you have been educated." Now, the word stupidity there, it's actually amatia, which in Greek really is best translated as unwisdom. So Socrates is basically saying to Alcibiades, you know, you have all these other good things going for you. The only thing you miss is the only one that really matters to make you a good statesman, and that is wisdom. You cannot possibly have that because you're young, for one thing. And second of all, because you're too much into yourself. Alcibiades is a narcissist. He's obviously into self-aggrandizing and things like that. And so Socrates says, it doesn't matter how rich you are, how strong you are, how brave you are. If you lack wisdom, only bad things are going to come out of it. And sure enough, Alcibiades, of course, ignores Socrates' advice, unfortunately, and arguably is single-handedly responsible for many of the catastrophes that will befall Athens during the Peloponnesian War. And he ends up having one of these, as I said, movie-like kind of lives where first, he's a general for the Athenians, but then the Athenians put him on trial because of the suspicions of impiety, you know, something he's done about some statues of the gods, and he escapes and defects to the Spartans. He helps the Spartans defeat the Athenians, but then he starts sleeping around with the Spartan queen, and the Spartan king does not appreciate that. So the Spartans now are after him, so he defects again and goes to Persia. And the Persians were enemies of both the Spartans and the Athenians, and Alcibiades helps them in turn. And then he also does something there that doesn't go quite right, so he's on the run again. And finally, the Spartans ask the the Persians to get rid of Alcibiades. And he's hunted down, his house is surrounded. And yet he's still, now he's in his mid-40s, he's still such an incredible character that even though surrounded by enemies, he rushes out of his house with his shield and weapons in hand, yelling his battle cry, and people are too afraid to engage in combat with him. So he's killed from a safe distance with a bunch of arrows.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting to read, you know, the story of Alcibiades, the sort of repeated treachery. I thought it was very interesting at one point, obviously an incredibly smart character. At one point he writes a letter where he essentially says, I didn't betray Athens. Athens betrayed me, right? You know, and how it's my duty, you know, to attack Athens because it's not the Athens that I know. And as a patriot, you know, I thought that had some interesting modern.
I know that. Yeah, exactly. That reminds me of a certain number of modern politicians who couldn't possibly go wrong, according to them. It's just it's reality that is wrong. It's the rest of the world that is wrong.
Right? Yeah. Yep. So question here, the story that you tell about Socrates and Alcibiades is so interesting. Socrates starts working with Alcibiades when Alcibiades is a young man. As Alcibiades gets older, he ends up doing all of these things that we would consider to be not virtuous, bad character. You couldn't ask for a better teacher than Socrates. So if Socrates failed with Alcibiades, what does that tell us about our ability to teach virtue? Is it something that if we have a pupil who, like Alcibiades, is smart, has everything going for him, but is just not receptive to the knowledge, is intrinsically is maybe intrinsically opposed to it? Is that a problem?
Yeah, it is a problem. But I would say that Socrates, in fact, did not fail. He actually saw exactly what Alcibiades' problems were, and he thought early on that this was not something that he could fix. And that's why he actually advises Alcibiades to just stay away from politics. In fact, turns out that Socrates, little known even to many modern readers, but Socrates actually engaged in this kind of political advice multiple times. You know, we tend to think of Socrates from the Platonic dialogues, the version of Socrates we get from Plato. But in fact, there are other sources. One of the other major sources of what Socrates was doing and how is Xenophon. Xenophon was also a student and friend of Socrates, like Plato. But Xenophon was not a philosopher. He was actually a general. And he was interested in more in politics than in philosophy. And Xenophon, in a book called The Memorabilia, which is about the life of Socrates, tells us that Socrates actually has given advice to a number of other people. He advised Glaucon, for instance, who was Plato's brother, as it turns out, not to go into politics because of similar reasons to Alcibiades. And Glaucon, unlike Alcibiades, actually listens to Socrates, and he becomes a really good musician instead. So Athens lost a bad statesman, potentially, and gained a good musician. And then later on, years later, Socrates gives advice to Charmides, who is Glaucon's son. And there he does the opposite. Charmides is shy. He doesn't want to get into politics. But Socrates thinks that Charmides has the right character. It has what it takes to do the right thing. And so he actually encourages him to go into politics. And Charmides does. And he's rather successful, although unfortunately for him, he happened to enter into politics during a really dark period of Athenian history. And there is yet another one, a guy named Euthydemus, who is boastful, just like Alcibiades initially, and Socrates says the same thing. He said, don't do this. And Euthydemus not only follows Socrates' advice, doesn't go into politics, but in fact, it becomes a regular student of Socrates. So this is interesting because it sets up an image of the philosopher, not necessarily as a teacher, but as a advisor, as somebody who says, you know, you probably shouldn't do this. Just go into music instead. Right. Or yes, you should do this, even though maybe you don't realize that you want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the story about how Socrates with Glaucon and his son was so interesting. So then would it be the case to say that Socrates did not believe that virtue or good character could be taught, but rather that he saw his role much more as identifying the characteristics that were already there, even in young people, and sort of doing what he could to either to steer them in a direction that would be beneficial for the society?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the answer is complicated. It's yes and no. Socrates sometimes actually states very clearly that he doesn't believe that that virtue can be taught. In the Meno, for instance, which is a Platonic dialogue, he says, look, you would think, but I don't see any teachers of virtue around. And you would think that if this was the kind of thing that you could teach, then somebody would be in the business of teaching it. But I don't see anybody who does that. So I have to conclude at least, you know, first look that no, it cannot be taught. But then in another Platonic dialogue, the Protagoras, Socrates is talking to Protagoras, who is a sophist. And the sophists usually are Socrates' arch enemies, right? They're the ones that essentially are the prototype of modern lawyers. They just argue whichever way is more convenient and teach people to argue whichever way is more convenient for them. So typically Socrates is an opponent of the sophists. But in the case of Protagoras, the dialogue starts out with Socrates saying, you know, I don't think that virtue can be taught. And Protagoras says, I think you're wrong. I think that he can. And then the two go into a number of arguments. And by the end of it, surprisingly, Socrates actually changed his mind. He's convinced by Protagoras and says, yeah, that's right. I think you're right. It can be taught. And the analogy here is this, that Protagoras suggests that virtue is a techne. It's a technique. It's a technical skill. And so it's something like playing a musical instrument. In fact, the analogy, I think, is actually much better than possibly even Plato thought at the time. Because if you think about it, anybody can learn a musical instrument at any age. However, if you're younger, you learn much better, much more quickly, and you become much more proficient. And that's because the human brain learns better until before the time it is completely formed, and that's in your early 20s. Right. So once you get into past your early 20s, you can still learn because the brain is still plastic enough. You can still manage to do things, but it becomes more difficult. It takes more effort and it doesn't come out as well. Nevertheless, you can. And you certainly before that age, you can be taught. But that teaching of virtue is very similar to the teaching of a musical instrument. How do you learn a new musical instrument? Well, first of all, you need a little bit of theory. Right, it's good to know the notations, you know, the relationship between the notes and stuff like that, a minimum of musical theory. Second, you need ideally a good teacher. Yes, you can learn an instrument on your own, but it's much better if you have a teacher who points out the form, who corrects you when you need to be corrected. And then it's mostly practice. Right? You just do those scales over and over and over. You just do your little tunes over and over and over until you improve. The same goes with virtue. You need a little bit of theory. That's philosophy. That's ethics. Ideally, you need a teacher. Usually, your teachers are your parents. You know, who teaches virtue to our kids? Who teaches morality to our kids? Usually, it's the parents. But you know, parents themselves only got it from their parents. And so it's like, you know, they're not exactly the best teacher that you can possibly imagine. So if you had a Socrates around, that would be better.
Right.
But then other than that, it's mostly about practice. And just like with music, you're going to make mistakes, especially early on. And that's okay. You just pick up and continue. I mean, you keep going until you get better and better over time. You might not get perfect. And in fact, you might not, you know, most of us don't get to play to Carnegie Hall, but if you do try, you will play a tune.
Right. Yeah, and I think to that point, I think it's Aristotle, right, who he writes maybe in the Nicomachean Ethics about how it's moral excellence. It's almost a habit. It comes out of a habit. And interesting, you talk about parents, right? Parents being the teachers, and you mentioned in the book some cases in which the parent was sort of an exemplar of virtue, and the child was less so. Pericles, I think you mentioned, his son was sort of known around Athens right. as being just sort of like a loser, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So exactly. So go ahead.
That's because you know even virtuous parents often don't have the skills to to teach somebody else. It's, as you know, it's one thing to be a good musician, and it's another thing to be able to teach music. Yes. They're not the same thing, right? We typically assume that they are very highly correlated, but just because you're good at something, it doesn't mean that you're good at teaching that something. So there are different set of skills for one thing, but also, you know, because parents have their own lives. Pericles had to run a state in the middle of a war. So, you know, he had other things to do.
Yeah. Speaking of Aristotle, he's another one who features in your book as a part of a very famous tutor pupil duo. Obviously, I'm talking about Aristotle and Alexander the Great. Maybe talk a little bit about their relationship.
Yeah, that one actually is a better example because Alexander did learn quite a bit from Aristotle, and in fact, arguably, Alexander, at least in one important sense, went beyond what Aristotle was teaching him, kind of extrapolated from Aristotle's teachings. One of the big deals that Aristotle was trying to teach Alexander was the concept of Pan-Hellenism. So this notion, Helen, of course, was Greece. And so there's this notion that all the Greek states should be united under one nation, because that is the way you defend yourself from, you know, the Persians and from whoever else wants to take over. And Greece, by contrast, had this history of fracture of, you know, Athens against Corinth, against Sparta, etc. And Aristotle had a point there, absolutely. But Alexander takes the ball and runs with it, and he says, well, why just Pan-Hellenism? Why not cosmopolitanism? Why not the entire world, right? And so one can see the Alexander's mature program of conquest as literally an attempt to unify the world, or at least the known world. And yes, of course, he was going about it by conquering people, true. But once he did that, he also immediately implemented a number of policies that were in fact meant to cement the connections between people. For instance, he organized these mass weddings between all of his generals and top staff and local women, right, including himself. And he also moved people. He encouraged to move people from one place to another within the empire so that they would mix. He established a bunch of cities. And why was that? Because the cities were the center of civilization. So, and of course, the most famous one of which, sorry, what was that?
He named them all after himself.
Exactly. Of course, he named them all after himself because, you know, he was a little bit of a megalomaniac. Yeah. But so you can say that within the historical context of the time, the relationship between Alexander and Aristotle worked much better. And part of the reason, I think, is because Alexander was actually prone to listen to Aristotle. That's one thing you have to have. The student has to be interested. But also because Alexander was very young. He was 16 or 17 when Aristotle got to him. But you've seen in the book there are other examples where that didn't work quite well. For instance, Seneca and Nero. Right? Sure. Nero also was 17 when Seneca became his tutor. However, Nero was already going in the wrong direction that early. So what happened was that Seneca, who was a Stoic philosopher, was actually able to rein in Nero for the first 5 years or so. And that is actually referred to as by scholars as the quinquennium Neronis, the 5 years of, you know, the golden 5 years of Nero. Things were actually going fairly well. But then Nero became more and more unhinged. And Seneca realized that, and he tried to retire. Unfortunately for him, that was not possible, made possible by the emperor.
Right. And did Nero command Seneca to kill himself? Is that right?
Yeah, because Seneca was accused of being part of the Pisonian conspiracy against Nero. And historians seem to agree that Seneca was actually not a member of the conspiracy, but that he probably did know about it and didn't tell the emperor, which for all effective purposes is being part of the conspiracy. You know, if you know that somebody's going to kill the emperor and you don't say anything, that's pretty much...
We often think of Nero as being so paranoid, but in reality, he had good reason. He had good reason to be paranoid, did he not?
He did. He did. I mean, modern historians. I just saw a few months ago a really great exhibit on Nero at the British Museum in London, and you know, historians are beginning actually to reassess Nero in a little bit more charitable fashion. For instance, you know, he's famous for the for his behavior during the big fire that destroyed most of Rome. And, you know, sometimes he's presented as, you know, fiddling, you know, playing the fiddle while the fire burns. First of all, he was out of town, actually, so he couldn't possibly have been, you know, playing the fiddle, at least not in that occasion. But what Nero actually did was to immediately send support to, you know, troops to Rome so that they could deal with the fire. And then he confiscated a bunch of property in the area and rebuilt and made it into a public gardens and, you know, public access. And one of the reasons the Senate did not like Nero is that the property that was expropriated was actually a lot of aristocrats' property, and, you know, a lot of senators lost their villas as a result. So they didn't like Nero as a, you know. Nero was complicated. He was definitely paranoid, but he had good reasons for paranoia. He famously did orchestrate to kill his mother, which to us sounds like an awful thing, right? Until you realize that his mother also had plotted to kill him. So it's like, well, all right. Now things are getting a little more complicated.
That's right. Let me ask you this, Massimo. Socrates, I believe, was very consistent on one point about virtue, which is that lack of virtue equated to ignorance. And we're not talking about ignorance here, right, in terms of not knowing the capital of Burkina Faso or something like that. This is like, right, like wisdom is what he's talking about, that a wise person would necessarily be a virtuous person. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was an interesting Socratic notion that was actually inherited and amplified by the Stoics. The Stoics also thought that nobody does evil on purpose. They only do it because they lack wisdom. Right? Mm-hmm. And now, whenever I bring up this idea, somebody immediately jumps the shark and says, what about Hitler? All right, so let's talk about Hitler for a second. So the idea is that even somebody as crazy and deranged as Hitler doesn't do evil because he thinks it is evil. He's not going in the morning, he's not getting up, going in front of the mirror and doing the, you know, the Disney sort of cartoonish villain, right, like, whoa, ha, ha, what can I do all today that it's evil? Even those kind of people do what they do because they think it's right. They are, of course, horribly mistaken about what is right, hence the lack of wisdom. Lack of wisdom means lack of understanding of how things really should be, right? But people tend to make these mistakes or even do horrible things as a result of ignorance in this sense. As you say, it's not academic. We're not talking about academic ignorance. We're not talking about somebody not knowing this or that fact. We're talking about unwisdom, the word that I mentioned earlier that Socrates uses with Alcibiades, amatia, which is translated as unwisdom. So now it's an interesting view of why bad things happen, right? It's a very charitable view if you think about it, because it means that people do things only because they're mistaken. That means one of two things, that either we can correct the mistakes, we can explain to them, like, look, this is actually the way to do things, or we need to stop them because they're incapable of understanding what the right thing to do is. The Stoic philosopher Epictetus makes an interesting analogy. He says, think of a bad what you call is a bad person. Think of him as a blind person. If you see a blind person going around the streets and, you know, he's stumbling around, he's you know, hurting other people because he doesn't know where he's going, you wouldn't put him in jail or you wouldn't put him to death. What you do is you first make sure that he doesn't hurt anybody or himself. And then if possible, you try to cure his blindness, but you're not going to kill him. And so this is the notion of, this is the origin of the notion that retributive justice is not the way to go, that justice should be about, you know, rehabilitation and not retribution.
That's interesting. I guess what I took Socrates as saying, and maybe you can tell me if this is incorrect, is that I thought that Socrates wasn't necessarily saying that someone could not do evil and know that he or she was doing evil. So, for example, if there was a person doing something very selfish, that person would know, oh, this is bad, this is selfish, but I'm still going to do it. What I thought Socrates was saying was, if that person actually was a wise person, he or she would know that in the long run, even selfishly, it made no sense to do something evil because that would be harming him or herself. So
that's correct.
Is that right? Yes. Okay.
Right. Yes, that is correct. That is, Socrates came up with what we would today call a psychological theory of the soul, in a sense. That your right, the welfare of your soul, the welfare of your psyche, ultimately depends on a on having achieved a good psychological state, and that psychological state has to do with being a good person, with acting pro-socially toward other people. Now, why? The question is that we would ask is like, okay, let's say that Socrates is correct, that, you know, that a good life ultimately is a life of pro-sociality, cooperation, et cetera. Why? And the answer, you know, Socrates couldn't know the answer, but we do. And the answer is we evolved as social primates. We have evidence from other social primates. There are other species of social primates that behave instinctively in a way that if you were to observe that behavior in a human being, you would say, oh, that person is acting moral. And yet other species of animals, of social animals, do that. And why is that? Well, because presumably natural selection built these kind of pro-social instincts into social species, into social primates especially, because that's how you survive. So ultimately, ironically, it is in fact about you, right? That meaning that pro-social behavior, being good to other people, etc., means that at the same time, you are being good to yourself. Ultimately, you're also taking care of yourself. The Stoics were very explicit about this. They thought that naturally, we are concerned with ourselves, that when we're born, the first thing we do is to try to get food for ourselves and trying to shield ourselves from pain and stuff like that. You realize first by instinct, and then later on by way of reason that reinforces that instinct, we realize that, yeah, but we are not going to go very far if we're just going to take care of ourselves. We need to make bonds and connections with other people because that is how we are ultimately going to thrive.
Massimo, you write about the connections between philosophy and politics, and how today, virtue is sort of, the idea of virtue is a little bit out of style. Politics has become a bit of a dirty word. But in your estimation, we should embrace, all of us as individuals, should embrace our participation in politics and also seek to become philosophers, in a sense. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's correct, so long as we understand what we mean by those words, right? The problem is that a lot of people seem to equate nowadays politics with partisanship. And those are not at all the same thing. Politics, the word politics, of course, from the Greek polis, and a polis is a city, it's a community, right? So to be political means to care about your community. And who wouldn't want to care about their community? Again, because caring for the community means that, in fact, ultimately you're caring for yourself and for your loved ones. So we should all be more political in that sense, not in the sense of partisan, of caring about the polis, trying to do our little, however, whatever that is, that may be, to improve the polis. And because we live essentially in a globalized society, we should care about the cosmopolis, what the ancient Cynics and Stoics called the cosmopolis, that is the city of the universal city of humanity. So that's one thing about politics. In terms of character and virtue, there too, you're right. The word has become something that, you know, a lot of people just don't care too much about. But that, I think, is because there is a misunderstanding largely of what it is that we're talking about. If by character you mean, you know, your excellence as a human being, as I said before, your arete being, why wouldn't you want to be the best human being that you can be, right? You know, you would think that's kind of a no-brainer. But unfortunately, the words virtue and character have gotten over time to a bad rap for historically understandable reasons and all that. But I think it's time to claim back those words, politics and character, because they really are important. I mean, ultimately, we're talking about trying to build a society that works well for us and works even better, ideally, for our children and grandchildren. And the only way to do that is to care about how you build that society and to do your part, however little that part may be.
Yeah. Yeah. We're so interested in civics education. That's a big area of interest for us. And we're constantly pointing out how little civics education students get. There are statistics, only this percentage of Americans can correctly identify the three branches of government, for example. I wonder, though, if civics education, if, for example, if educating students about the three branches of government, if that's necessary but not sufficient. In other words, if there doesn't need to be also this virtue component to civics education. Right. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that civics is important, is crucial. And in fact, this is not a recent discovery. I was just rereading this morning De Republica, which is a book by Marcus Tullius Cicero, Roman Republican philosopher. And he was saying, there's no such thing as a good statesman unless that person knows the laws of the land and how they're supposed to work and how the different powers are supposed to balance each other. So, yeah, it is in everybody's interest to know better the mechanics, essentially, of our society and our laws, at least to some extent. But I think you're also absolutely right that is necessary but not sufficient. What we need at least as much, if not arguably more, is ethical teaching. We leave ethical teaching, as I said before, to our parents, who by and large are not equipped for that sort of teaching, or we leave it to religious authorities, who I would argue also ill-equipped to do that kind of teaching. Yeah, you mentioned a minute ago the figure of the philosopher. Philosopher here, of course, in this context, doesn't mean somebody like me with a PhD in philosophy who teaches at a City College in New York and writes some very abstract and very abstruse things. A philosopher in Greece and Rome was anybody who practiced the art of living. Anybody who was living their life by thinking about what they needed to do and questioning their priorities and trying to do the right thing, that is a philosopher. That's what a philosopher is. So in that sense, we can all be philosophers. And I saw a really great example of how that might work. Recently, I went to see a documentary entitled Young Plato that is about a principal of an elementary school in Ireland, in Belfast, of all places, who tries to teach his kids about philosophy, but not, again, about the sort of the metaphysics and abstract stuff, but about ethics. And I mean, the piece is incredible. I mean, you see these kids reacting really well to these teachings because they're practical teachings. He's not just telling them the theory. He's then applying that theory to an episode of bullying, for instance, in the schoolyard, or to another kid who has been harassed outside of the school, or et cetera, et cetera. So these are, or of course, these kids, because of where they live, they are exposed to violence on a regular basis, or their parents have been exposed to violence, and they have a tradition of, divisions from their neighbors. And the teacher, the principal, tackles all of these topics by way of philosophy. And interestingly, although he teaches philosophers from all ages, from all times, it mostly is about the Greco-Romans, and particularly about Socrates and the Stoics, because those are the most practical of the philosophers, at least in the Western tradition. There are similar traditions, for instance, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism in the Eastern traditions are essentially doing the same thing. But yeah, so I think that civics are certainly important. I would say much more important than other topics that we normally teach as a matter of course in pre-college school. But ethics is just as important. Ethics, and I would say critical thinking. So in other words, philosophy broadly construed. But we don't do that. And in fact, with exceptions. And in fact, at least in the United States, there's typically two sources of resistance to teaching ethics and critical thinking at a pre-college level. One is politicians, local politicians, and the other one is parents themselves.
Okay.
And I thought for a while about this. It's like, you know, why? What do these two categories of people have in common? And well, the answer, one potential answer is they are authority figures. And authority doesn't like people to start questioning and start asking embarrassing questions. I mean, in the movie that I just mentioned, Young Plato, there is one wonderful moment where the principal says to one of the kids, okay, what I'm going to teach you now is to question your parents. It's like, wait, what?
Right.
The kid is completely out of his mind at that point. But it's like, yeah. Because in this particular case, your parents are teaching you things that are not right. This was a reference to the violence between Catholics and Protestants in Ireland. Yeah. And so you need to question them.
Yeah. I that's interesting you said that. I recall very vividly all throughout my primary schooling being told repeatedly by teachers, you have to question authority. You weren't supposed to, not at school, apparently. Don't do it
except
here.
Except mine, right. Except mine.
Except mine, yeah, right. Question any authority but mine. So I want to ask you one other question as we're wrapping up here, Massimo, about we talk about the sort of structures of government that we have in this country, the three branches of government. We had a conversation not long ago about the Supreme Court with some attorneys. And who served actually on President Biden's commission on the Supreme Court. And one of them was saying that at the end of the day, a lot of this, we can talk about structure and that's very important, but a lot of this comes back to self-restraint on the part of the people who are actually in this structure. And you write in the book about this idea of, is it pronounced maiorum? Maiorum? This notion of sort of the norms and traditions that restrain the conduct of the people within structure, and how important that is. It's sort of unwritten, sort of right rules, traditions. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that concept again comes from Cicero, and in De Republica, which is essentially his answer to Plato's famous Republic. Cicero asks himself, you know, how do we build a good functioning commonwealth? And it goes through a number of, you know, considerations, one of which is we need both good people, people who actually act in the way, you know, in a reasonable pro-social fashion, as well as good institutions. He says explicitly, good people without good institutions don't get very far, but good institutions by themselves are insufficient also. If you have good institutions, but the people start ignoring the basics of pro-social behavior, of community living, then you're not going anywhere. No institution is that resilient. No institution is such that it can do without the help of the people that are supposed to work in it. I mean, we've seen examples in our own republic over the last few years, right? So it used to be that if you get a subpoena from Congress, you appear in Congress and you respond to the subpoena. But if all of a sudden somebody says, you know what, I just don't feel like it, I'm not going to do it, and there are no consequences, then that's the beginning of the end, because that's the moment when you show other people that they too can get away with not playing by the rules, basically. Cicero was very aware of how that works at a grander scale, because that's exactly what Julius Caesar had done when he famously crossed the Rubicon, right? The Rubicon was this little river which doesn't exist anymore, incidentally, in northern Italy, you know, went underground. It was a little thing. It was a entirely symbolic border, right, between Italy proper and the other provinces. And the idea was that if a Roman general or anyone really crossed the Rubicon with soldiers, that was essentially a declaration of war, and no Roman had ever done that until Caesar crossed the Rubicon with one legion. The rules were there. The institutions were there. It was illegal to do that, but he had the legion and he decided to cross. And when he famously said, when crossing the Rubicon, he famously said, "Alea iacta est," the die is cast, right? He knew very well what he was doing. Yeah. He knew that he had crossed not just a physical boundary, but a moral boundary. And that was sure enough the beginning of the end for the Republic, because after that, people started ignoring the rules all the time, and the Senate and Republic of Rome became a joke. And in the end, the joke was resolved by turning the place into an empire.
Right. Words that we should yeah, right, absolutely.
You know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
Right. I like that. That's good.
If you listen to the rhymes, you get the message anyway.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Massimo, the work that you're doing to present these rich writings and these rich stories from the past, from antiquity, and to bring them to a lay audience and show us how these still have incredible reverberations in our lives and in our societies is so important. Thank you so much for doing it. You do it with a certain, what's the Italian word, sprezzatura. And it's really delightful.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So thank you for your work. And thank you for spending some time to talk with us today about your new book.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.